You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported,
community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting for WFHB, this is Jim Odom.
And I'm Cade Young. You're listening to the WFHB local news for Tuesday, April 9th, 2024.
Later in the program, you'll hear an interview from Kinsey Institute Executive Director Justin Garcia with host Michael Glab. More in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Lil Bub's Lil Show, a co-production between WFHB and Lil Bub's Big Fun. But first, your local headlines.
The Monroe County Election Board met on April 4th and listened to almost 40 minutes of hearings related to late candidate finance document submissions. During the hearings, many candidates referenced misunderstandings with deadlines or documents as reasons for their late submissions. According to a ruling passed by the Election Board in February of 2023, after incurring two late notices, a third can result in late fees of $50 per day up to $1,000. Chair of the Monroe County Democrats, David Henry, called into question the effectiveness of the current notification system, citing the number of candidates who expressed issues with notifications.
Today, I ask respectfully that the board consider some changes to our adopted policy on fines for late CFAs that was adopted in February of last year. This was a policy that, of course, was adopted during my term on the election board. And so I understand a bit of the spirit in the letter of what we were trying to do and helping to manage the process here. But after a year, it may make sense to revisit some of how this has worked out and how our notifications are working. Secondly, I want to honor the fact that I know this is an administrative burden for the election operations and the board, and that as we've heard here mentioned today, a courtesy extended to candidates. It's by no means an obligation under code to let our candidates know when they are late for things. However, I think we've heard several cases of inconsistency or misunderstandings about when things are due.
Henry added that the current rules make it harder for non-party affiliated candidates because they do most of the work on their own.
For nonpartisan candidates, there's no intermediary to let them know. It's really up to the board and its operations. We have two school board members here, five. Can I get six? On that, there's no way for nonpartisan candidates to get that same information flow that the two parties have enjoyed under the current policy that may need to be looked at.
Board member John Fernandez acknowledged that there must be an issue with the current system given the length of time spent discussing late fees at the meeting. He suggested that to save time, the board postpone the discussion for remedies until the next meeting.
If not, I'd like to make a suggestion because honestly, I've got a lot to say on this. But I think that I would suggest to my colleagues that we hold back discussions on the current state of these policies and put it on a future agenda to clarify how we're going to handle this from an administrative perspective. I don't want to diminish the importance of these kinds of filings. They're super important in terms of our system to have transparency, to be compliant with the state law and local rules. But we also need to think about administrative efficiencies and the role we play in providing a service as well. But I think there are a number of issues that require discussion and maybe clarification.
The board unanimously agreed to table discussion on the candidate finance documentation notifications and fees until a later meeting. The next meeting of the Monroe County Election Board will be held on May 2nd.
On April 1st, the City of Bloomington held a combined commission meeting with representatives from Tool Design Group to discuss the Safe Streets and Roads for All grant program. Tool Design Senior Planner Drew Parker gave some background information on the program.
So Safe Streets and Roads for All is a grant program that the United States Department of Transportation put out as part of President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure law. And the US DOT had a national roadway safety strategy, and the US DOT, so our entire country, has a goal of zero roadway deaths, but this grant program really put some money in front of that. So $5 billion was allocated to that program from 2022 to 2026, and the applications are on an annual cycle. As part of that, there's two different pots of money. There's the planning and demonstration grants. So that funds, generally speaking, the creation of action plans like what we're doing here. It also funds demonstration projects. So going and putting something out in the community, seeing how it does, some sort of safety countermeasure, and seeing how it does and evaluating it. And then the other side of that, where there's a really big portion of the pot of money that's available, is in implementation grants. And so these grants are on the order of millions to tens of millions of dollars for communities to get construction projects in the ground to reconstruct their streets and make them safer. So there's a lot of money available. And a lot of communities have already won those grants, but a prerequisite to getting those implementation grants is you have to have an action plan published. So that's a big part of what we're doing here, is putting together this action plan so then eventually we can apply for an implementation grant.
Parker said that many communities, per the U.S. Department of Transportation recommendations, are moving to a safe system approach. He further discusses the main difference between the traditional approach and the safe system approach to road safety.
This slide talks about the difference between the traditional approach and the safe system approach. So the traditional approach to traffic safety engineering says we should just prevent crashes. That should be the ultimate goal. But the safe system approach says we're not going to eliminate all crashes, but we do want to prevent death and serious injuries if a crash does occur. So we're really focused on those fatal and serious injury crashes. So you'll see that a lot throughout the presentation tonight. The traditional approach, and you'll see this a lot in a lot of different places, talks about improving human behavior and talking about fault and crashes. Who was at fault? What were they doing? That's the first thing that people think about. Well, whose fault was it there was a crash? Well, the safe system approach says we don't really care. We just should design a system knowing that humans are going to make mistakes and people are flawed and they make mistakes. But if they do make a mistake, it shouldn't be fatal. The traditional approach also says we need to control speeding, whereas the safe system approach says we should reduce system kinetic energy. And that one's kind of confusing, but the point of that is we can't easily control speeding per se without putting speed limiters on vehicles. But we can reduce system kinetic energy, which means we can use things like impact attenuators, like you see on the highway, so that if someone is traveling fast and they hit something, it slows them down and reduces the kinetic energy before an impact occurs. So that's kind of an example of that one. That one's a little bit more confusing, but the overall idea is that we're building a system that's forgiving, our transportation system. The traditional approach, also similar to improving human behavior, has always said individuals are responsible for crashes. But the safe system approach says this is a shared responsibility. It's something that we all have a stake in. We all need to act to improve. The traditional approach also has said we should react based on crash history. We should just look at the places that have the most crashes and focus on those. The safe system approach says that's important. We should look at crash analysis, but we should also proactively identify and address risks. So just because there's crashes one place and there's not crashes another place doesn't mean tomorrow a crash can't occur there because the street is designed in a way that's unsafe.
According to Tool Design, from 2018 to 2022, Bloomington had a total of 756 fatal and serious injury crashes. They're hoping to reduce crashes by 7% every year until 2039, where the goal is to have zero fatal and serious injury crashes. Bloomington Planning Services Manager Ryan Roebling explained why the year 2039 was chosen.
We picked 2039 as an achievable goal. We wanted to actually achieve this goal rather than just set a date and hope for the best. So we picked 15 years as a date where we thought we could definitely achieve this, given the fact that the numbers change yearly and some things are temporarily outside of our control. So we picked that as the year that we thought we could actually accomplish this one goal that we set for ourselves.
Residents can find out more information about Bloomington's Safe Streets for All planning efforts at bloomington.in.gov/transportation/SS4A. The next Bloomington's Safe Streets for All meeting will be held in May or June of this year.
In today's feature report, we have an archived interview from Big Talk, our public affairs program featuring one-on-one conversations with some of Bloomington's most fascinating people. Today's excerpt features Kinsey Institute Executive Director Justin Garcia.
This episode was aired a little more than a year after the Indiana legislature voted to bar state funding for the Kinsey Institute, the world-renowned human sexuality research center. The IU Board of Trustees voted on March 1st, 2024, to keep the Institute after considering to allow it to spin off as an independent nonprofit in the wake of the State House ban. Dr. Garcia recounts the reactions of faculty, researchers, and supporting academics around the world, while the Institute's future appeared to be up in the air.
We turn to Michael Glab, host of Big Talk, for a portion of that interview. To hear the full interview, visit WFHB.org.
My guest this week is the executive director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, Dr. Justin Garcia. Justin, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here and to be with you.
The trustees of Indiana University voted to keep the relationship with the Kinsey Institute. The Kinsey Institute, founded in 1947 by Alfred Kinsey, who was an entomologist, and then decided to switch to human sexuality research. Now, he was the head of the institute, the executive director, until 1956. Then come July 1st, 2019, Justin Garcia was named the executive director.
Yep, I did 1 year as interim director, and then in 2019, exactly, and then after that I was appointed full-time executive director.
And I think we did this, we had our fingers out and we were counting. You're the eighth executive director in total.
That's right. There are seven directors, and then Dr. Stephanie Sanders, who is still on our faculty, she's our current research director, served as interim director 3 times, so she's a remarkable power to steady the ship in between transitions. Sometimes one time for 2 years, so she's a force and a brilliant scholar. I'm glad she's on our faculty.
The work has gone on. It continues to go on. Lo and behold, about a year ago, in February of 2023, a member of the Indiana House came up with an amendment for the state's 2-year budget plan, the actual bill that says, where does money go? And the amendment says, no to money from the state going to the Kinsey Institute. How did you all react to that?
Oh, gosh, it was what a sucker punch. And especially because for us, it was just coming off the Institute's 75th anniversary celebrations. So we had we unveiled the sculpture of Dr. Kinsey on campus, what are called legacy sculptures on campus. We had a 75th anniversary research symposium, scholars and scientists from around the world sharing late-breaking studies. And we really were in a celebration mode of all the research accomplishments that had happened. So it came after that. In some sense, perhaps the positive attention we were getting in Bloomington and Indiana and around the world upset some. Now, what's interesting is sometimes I'll hear people say that the Institute is controversial or Dr. Kinsey's work was controversial. And I want to push back on that because I don't think it ever has been controversial per se, but it has always been the subject of attack. It has been the subject of misinformation and attack since its very founding. And lurid rumors about Dr. Kinsey himself and the researchers at the Institute back then and continuing to this day. So what we saw was the legislature fell victim to that misinformation and made legislative action based on it.
The bill was introduced by Representative Larissa Sweet, Republican from Wabash. Ms. Sweet basically said, IU harbors sex offenders. I don't know what the heck that means. Part of her argument was that Kinsey himself had interviewed some people who either had committed child molestation or had thought about it or fantasized, what have you. And basically she said, aha, you're condoning that kind of thing.
It's a very strange interpretation of reality and facts. So what Dr. Kinsey did as a research method in the 1940s was he wanted to capture everyone in a population. So if you are doing 18,000 interviews, that might mean you went to the Elks Club. And if you interviewed one person, they would attempt what was called saturation. They would say, we're now going to get everyone at this Elks Club. They were pockets that they tried to saturate, little subgroups. And they said, if we're going to talk to a subgroup, let's try and get all of them. So they really tried for their method to be, at the time, something close to representative. We know today it wasn't exactly representative for all sorts of reasons, and statisticians and demographers have said it's not the methods we would use today, almost 8 decades later, as it should be. Science is iterative, and it changes, and it improves. But Kinsey's idea was that he wanted to get information from everyone and share that information with the world. So there was no cleansing or hiding of the data. So
A bad guy, so you're not going to be in it.
Exactly. And in fact, they had a lot of data from prisoners, from sex offenders, from sex workers. So part of that was they interviewed a lot of people who had experienced sexual violence. They also interviewed people who perpetrated sexual violence. Huh. And the researchers made the decision at the time that they were going to report everything that they learned from those participants. That included people who were perpetrators of violence, and they reported on the experiences they had. In one case, it was someone who sexually abused children, and he shared those experiences. And the research team said, well, that's now in the data set. This person has told us experiences they have. Our method, our promise as scientists was that we were going to share everything that we learned. So that data was shared. I think today researchers would handle that differently, and there would be more cautions, and there would be more...
No kidding.
There would be, I think, a lot more clarity about... there's also different regulations and laws about when you interview participants who have committed crimes or who are a danger to themselves or others.
Or maybe you have to report it the minute you hear it.
Yeah.
Well, Ms. Sweet's amendment to the budget was passed 53-34, with 7 Republicans joining all the Democrats voting against it. That very same day, the Senate, the Indiana Senate, approved a bill prohibiting healthcare workers from giving gender-affirming care for trans children. I guess they said, let's take care of all the sexual and gender stuff in one fell swoop. Well, there was worry. If state funds are being cut off from the Kinsey Institute, how does the Kinsey Institute survive?
And I remember at the time there were claims that the Institute was practicing gender-affirming care. And just as a point of fact, we're not a clinic. We don't practice care one way or another. And that's part
of... Or advocate.
Or advocate. The Institute has never been an advocacy organization. We are and have always been an unbiased, apolitical source of scientific and scholarly research. We're a research institute through and through. The Institute has 3 wings. There's 10 laboratories and research centers within the Institute. We have an education and outreach program, and we have the library and special collections. And that sort of forms what the Kinsey Institute is today. And this legislation to limit any state funding, it was state appropriation dollars. Here was the bizarre part is the Institute never had state appropriation dollars. So we are on the Indiana University campus, and we benefit enormously from the relationship with IU. For much of the early years of the Institute's history, it was a separate nonprofit at IU. it was because of Dr. Kinsey and Herman Wells, very early on, were worried about outside influence.
Yeah, it was a nonprofit corporation up until 2016, I understand.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And actually, it's an interesting story. So when the Institute was founded in 1947, the original funder was the Rockefeller Foundation. And Dr. Kinsey and President Wells and the Rockefeller Foundation agreed to form this separate nonprofit for three very explicit reasons. One was to protect the data and the participants who provided that data. Kinsey was way ahead of his time in thinking about issues of consent and protecting research participants. Even if you look at his writings and his speeches about human sexuality, the importance of honoring people who share stories, of sex being an experience that should be consensual and pleasurable. Ahead of his time in so many ways, as was President Wells, such a defender of academic freedom, as we know. And they felt that the separate nonprofit, those three reasons were to protect the data and the participants who provided that data at a time that a government agency could maybe come in and say, let's identify the homosexuals and put them in a mental institution.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. So really protecting the people. The other was to protect the growing collections. At the time, there were about 15,000 items, artifacts, and photography that Dr. Kinsey was in possession of. He had donated those to the then Institute. But to protect those from being sold or seized. And the third reason, which is, I think, brings us again to the present moment, was that if Indiana University or the state of Indiana became too inhospitable for the Institute for Sex Research, that's what it was then called, to continue to operate and thrive, that it could move from Indiana University. So those were the three reasons that it was set up initially that way.
So independence, which protected it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now this big amendment comes up and is passed by the state legislature, and someone comes up with the idea to go nonprofit again.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
Yeah, so in 2016, the Institute and IU were merged. So the separate nonprofit was merged. The assets, the hundreds of thousands of items in the special collections, currently around 650,000 items, rare artifacts and photography and books and manuscripts and data sets, they were transferred from the Kinsey Institute, which had its own separate independent board of trustees. They were transferred then to Indiana University. So that was what happened in 2016, in part because it was always a messy relationship. Although it was a separate nonprofit, it was always on the Indiana University campus. The faculty were given tenure in IU departments. So it was always a kind of fairly complicated relationship. So the thought in 2016 was, let's clean this up. IU will always defend academic freedom, and IU will always defend the Kinsey Institute, were the words in 2016 that brought people so much comfort in saying, this has been a wonderful relationship for so many years. We can make sure it will continue to be that way.
But as part of Indiana University, that means state officials, state legislators can get their hands on the stuff.
This is exactly the concern. That was the concern in 2016 with the merger. And so there were a lot of protections put in place at that time.
Uh-huh.
So with this, what it means is since then, it's the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. We've been fully integrated. Our faculty span multiple schools, the College of Arts and Science, medicine, nursing, public health, informatics, law. What the Institute does, the big intellectual enterprise, is that you can go up and down the hall and there's neuroscientists and historians and anthropologists and psychologists all bringing their own methods to bear on studying sex and sexuality. Not trying to create a department or a discipline, but saying a truly multidisciplinary endeavor to understand sexuality, to understand ourselves, to understand society, to understand the world around us. So that was the mission. That is still the mission of the Institute. The issue of state appropriation dollars was then what we call indirects. And it's this question of, well, what about the university? If the university receives some of its funding, as many people know, it's a minority of its funding from the state, how could that then be used or not used towards the Institute? So what we heard from the state is, don't use any of those state dollars to support the Institute. it requires a fairly complex accounting solution to address financial flow, of dollar flow, to make sure. Now, we can do that. We have the enormous talent at the university in our accounting and budgeting and controllers offices to make that happen. But that's an exercise we've been pursuing. This was not a benign legislation. It concerned our constituents, our faculty, our students, and it's required enormous effort to track funds. And it's required increased fundraising to support the work of the Institute.
Up next, Lil Bub's Lil Show, a co-production between WFHB and Lil Bub's Big Fund. We turn now to that segment on the WFHB local news.
Welcome to Lil Bub's Lil Show, a weekly co-production from WFHB and Lil Bub's Big Fund. We highlight adoptable animals with special needs in South Central Indiana and spotlight topics to promote human-animal welfare. Today's episode of Lil Bub's Lil Show is being recorded at our home, so you may hear some of our pets close by. Today we delve into the critical topic of spaying and neutering, essential practices in animal welfare that affect not only individual pets, but our entire community and ecosystem. Spaying and neutering, the procedures to prevent animals from breeding, are more than just population control measures. They carry significant health and behavioral benefits for pets. For instance, spaying female pets prevents uterine infections and breast tumors, which are malignant or cancerous in about 50% of dogs and 90% of cats. Neutering male pets can prevent testicular cancer and reduce behaviors like roaming and aggression. The necessity of these procedures extends beyond health. In the United States alone, millions of animals are euthanized in shelters each year due to overpopulation. Spaying and neutering can drastically reduce this number, easing the burden on already overstretched animal shelters and rescue organizations. These practices not only lower the number of animals entering shelters, but also contribute to fewer animals being euthanized. Beyond domestic animal welfare, spaying and neutering have significant environmental implications. For example, stray and feral cat populations can have a detrimental impact on local wildlife, particularly bird species. By controlling these populations through responsible pet ownership, we can help preserve our local ecosystems and protect wildlife. Recognizing the economic barriers some pet owners face, numerous initiatives offer low-cost or free spaying and neutering services, ensuring that these essential procedures are accessible to all pet owners regardless of their financial status. Spaying and neutering are pivotal actions in the realm of animal welfare, with far-reaching benefits that extend beyond individual pets to touch on broader environmental and community health. As responsible pet owners and community members, we have the power to affect significant change through these practices. By embracing and promoting spaying and neutering, we contribute to a healthier, more sustainable world for all living beings. Today's featured pet comes from our Bloomington, Indiana animal shelter. Bryn is a sweet dog looking for a home, and here's what shelter staff had to say about her. Bryn has been sitting with us for a long while. She is nearly perfect, aside from not living well with cats and kids. She is house-trained, chatty, gives the best kisses, and has an adorably perfect snore. She does well loose and out of a crate, but she does have allergies, which make her care more expensive than the average dog's. She is currently taking Apoquil daily and recently started another medication along with it. Bryn's monthly care is about $175 each month. If Bryn's care is out of reach financially, but you'd like to adopt her, please reach out to me via email at stacy@lilbub.com. That's STACY at LILBUB.com. Thank you for tuning in to Lil Bub's Lil Show on WFHB. Produced in partnership with Lil Bub's Big Fund. Find us online at goodjobbub.org and WFHB.org.
Support for WFHB Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. More information online at mpisolarenergy.com.